Okay. I propose that we proceed in the same way that we did last time for this week's session, going through the interrogations rather than distilling an agenda from it. In any case, I didn't distill an agenda from it, so at this point I think that's the default option. One thing we can do, since we didn't get through everybody's interrogation last time, as we go through, if we come to someone who we discussed theirs at length last time, we could skip over and then come back to them if we have time, if that seems reasonable enough. Okay. Catherine, we read hers last time as well, so why don't we start this time with Ito?
Oh, really?
Well, you were very efficient this week. You got your... But you're sick.
Yes, I'm sick. No, I'm okay. This interrogation and me trying to summarize it right now are both products of a fever-addled mind. Not really. But the writing was. I actually thought that the issue that Molly expressed in her interrogation articulated what I wanted to say a little bit better than I did, which was the issue of scalability of interstitial transformation, which is that it seems that interstitial transformations, I thought the biggest limitation, although they're also very legitimate and I thought the whole discussion was very interesting, my concern was that interstitial transformations would hit some sort of a limit or not be able to catalyze systemic change as long as they're isolated pockets of transformation within capitalism as a social structure or as a social system. But I thought that Molly's issue of scalability really spoke to that better than I did in my interrogation.
Why don't you add your scalability point to it?
I mean, I think that was basically it, I guess. And I guess this also relates to my thought about the state in relation to interstitial strategy, or basically that I wouldn't see the possibility of the examples you gave or any other interstitial strategy being able to achieve a scale without the state taking a really active role in embracing those strategies or providing. I don't know. I guess it was hard for me to. I understood that it was that these were activities and strategies geared towards working outside the state, but I just saw the state playing such a pivotal role in providing the space for those. And I couldn't see how any of them could achieve scalability without strong negotiation with the state or having like powers in the state that were that could help them in some way. Otherwise, we could just see them as being small bubbles within a capitalist state without achieving social transformation on a larger scale.
Can we add to that also negative externalities to the idea of scalability? That was probably one of the points I tried to touch on, is that probably what will happen is if we have a nice proposal, it's going to create negative externalities.
The socialist revolution has no negative externalities.
But why are negative externalities a specific problem to interstitial strategies?
It might not be specific to interstitial, but it is one of the outcome, perhaps. And I had in mind the co-op, specifically the co-op, because it's, although we have a very interesting project of cooperative governance and a social capitalism that is fair to everyone, I think here, it's an agent for gentrification. If we agree that the co-op is an interesting model, I don't think we should jettison the fact that some people might be not expropriated, but will be displaced in the future from their neighborhood, because where the co-op is located used to be a low-income area.
Guillaume was talking about the Williamson Street co-op.
I really have that co-op.
I mean, I think there's a difference between a worker co-op and that type of co-op in terms of the externalities that it creates. I think they have a very... I think there could be parallels drawn, but I think that...
You guys are all aware of where the, or know about the co-op and where it's located. I think the point I'm trying to get is that the co-op also produces a certain aesthetic that a worker co-op located in an industrial district would not produce. The aesthetic that is produced in the neighborhood is probably pivotal to the displacement of poor residents. Right. This is probably the aspect that I think that might be difficult to deal with if we treat the interstitial strategy as not being cast in a wider net.
Let's hold that particular point for a moment on the side. We can come back to it. I think there's two connected issues that are raised around the scalability one. One has to do with whether or not it's at all plausible to push an interstitial strategy very far without the direct involvement of the state, as opposed to the state simply being part of the structure of the system whose interstices are being exploited through these strategies. So whether the state actually has to be enlisted. How far can interstitial strategies go without directly trying to enlist the state on behalf of those strategies? That's one kind of question. And the other is whether interstitial strategies, are essentially doomed to just fill little problem-solving niches, or whether that they could be the core of a transformative strategy. So even if the state might need to be enlisted, it's only being enlisted in order to enhance interstitial strategies as opposed to for other purposes. So it still would be an interstitial strategy-centered transformative project where from time to time the state gets involved for one reason or another, but it isn't a state-driven project still, if one could make that distinction. What I'd like to do is have you kind of give the best case you could. Give the strongest arguments. Imagine that you're all really committed anarchists or autonomists.
Yeah, my comment was because, I mean, I didn't explain it, but I think it's more than in the last Argentinian crisis, the most important debate among the people in the street or political activists was with autonomist proposals, not anarchist as labeled as that. So that's why I thought maybe it was a worldwide phenomenon that the anarchist proposals we're now framing the autonomist. I wasn't referring to the Italian 70s, but more to the Argentinian crisis where like autonomists in unemployed movements and...
I don't know empirically whether or not it's the case that in the rhetoric of these social movements, autonomism, in English it certainly hasn't displaced anarchism as the language. Unless people are being very esoteric, they don't refer to themselves as autonomists in English. In Southern Europe, it certainly was important in the 70s into the 80s. I don't know if more generally there has been a displacement. Anarchism as a general philosophical position, of course, stretches back and has a long pedigree. In English, it's contaminated by the use of the term anarchy to mean just chaos, as opposed to meaning, you know, grassroots, cooperative, voluntarist, associational activity. So there are problems with the language in English as well for that reason. But in any case, for the purposes of our discussion, let's just see how far you think you could go. I mean, how central could interstitial strategies in your expansive imagination be for a transformative project? Yeah, Tom.
This isn't a direct answer to that question, but getting back to Molly's point, I think I want to know more about what the specific state interventions that we have in mind are, and also what other kinds of organizations could provide those interventions. So part of the problem is capital, right? So how do co-ops finance themselves? So if there's some sort of institutional articulation of extensive producer co-ops and consumer co-ops with some sort of mechanism for providing capital, so, you know, 15% of pension funds have to be invested in cooperative enterprises or something like that. Now, is that something that could be a state regulation, right? That could be the state saying to union pension funds, you have to invest in cooperative enterprises, or that could be somehow that the unions are going to voluntarily decide to do, right? So, but the funds themselves might not be actually state funds, right? Or it could be the case that the state is itself going to directly provide capital to cooperative enterprises. But the interventions might also not only be in terms of financing, so it could be, you know, providing other kinds of sort of labor regulations or other kinds of sort of regulatory things that would facilitate, you know, producer cooperatives in particular. So I just want to know what the actual role is for the state and also other kinds of organizations to facilitate. I think that on their own, there are these sort of pretty serious limitations on how much cooperatives can accomplish, but, you know, in cooperation with other kinds of organizations is sort of where it starts to get interesting.
I mean, I would think what you said are good examples of how the state could become involved, like any sort of incentive, subsidies, tax stuff, or maybe a non-state institution could be credit unions, and I know credit unions now don't necessarily play that role, although I think there's one in Canada that is pretty big and is pretty committed to financing like organizations. So I don't know if that's something outside of the state that you were thinking of, an institution that could generate capital for cooperatives or other sort of transformatory organizations. Any other ideas?
If we agree with Todd's proposal, would it not be closer to a symbiotic transformation than a interstitial? Because the state would be very much engaged in providing regulations and financial resources.
Right, and see, I mean, you have to remember the reason why anarchists and the anarchist tradition advocates for interstitial strategies rather than trying to harness the state for it is because of the belief that harnessing the state to these projects ends up harnessing the projects to the state. That there is just no way to navigate successfully that relationship if you're an insurgent, oppositional, counter-hegemonic force. If you're attempting to really transform basic social relesions, the thesis, I suppose, the bottom line thesis of anarchism with respect to that problem is it's a Faustian bargain. Every time you try to get the state to help you out, you end up getting screwed by the state because there are always conditions. You create dependencies in which you become dependent upon the state and therefore lose your capacity to act independently of the state. And since the state is seen as an instrument of domination, and in the more Marxian versions of this, an instrument of class domination, not just, you know, sheer domination. While on the one hand it's very appealing, you could solve all sorts of problems with the state, the view is this is ultimately going to destroy the possibilities of transformation. Now, if that, you know, that may or may not be right, you know, there's lots of arguments why the state has more contradictions, there's more possibilities than it's allowed for that, but it's not an absurd view, obviously. Historical experiences are filled with cases where you make a deal with the state to get resources and you end up undercutting your capacity for action as a result. So I think before we too quickly say, yes, we know in advance already that interstitial strategies are only going to be small, niche, fragmented, isolated, and won't amount to much. That's the standard revolutionary Marxist critique of these kinds of strategies. I think it would be good for us to see how much we could support the view that, no, you don't go to the state for this. It's not that you wouldn't struggle to force the state to make co-ops legal, for example, if they weren't legal. I mean, you might want to avoid the police raiding your co-op every time you try to create one. So it's not that you never challenge the state, but you don't ask the state for help on these things. You just want the state to stay out of your way. And that might mean a confrontation with the state. But the strategy of building new institutions, you don't want to relinquish your complete autonomy. That's indeed why I think the autonomist variant shifted the language. It's the preservation of an autonomous sphere of action that's at stake in this kind of idea.
I guess maybe I could see without the states, and I mean, if the major problem with co-ops is, scalability and access to capital, if there is maybe, collaboration between co-ops, and this could maybe speak to Guillaume's concern with gentrification issues, is that if co-ops that are established, if it maintains in their ideology to kind of spread that ideology and to play an active role in the formation of other co-ops and engage other communities and try and figure out ways of building capital for the movement to spread. But,
Charity.
The only way I find the interstitial strategies helpful is in light of thinking about Gramsci, as you point out.
I think that
So the only way I find interstitial strategies useful is in thinking about Gramsci, as you point out in your footnotes, and the idea of building counter hegemony. But I think that leads me back to what I think Guillaume's point was. I apologize for missing the beginning of that. Because I see interstitial strategies as often a luxury, and often, if not on purpose, but indirectly exclusive of the working class, and thus that working class common sense or truth, as we have talked about in Michael's talks, how effective then is interstitial strategies in actually building a true counter-hegemony or a counter-hegemony with that common sense or ultimate truth built into it? So how is it just partial and is it exclusive?
One of the things I was thinking of, there's been a lot of, when I think of the role of the state in interstitial strategies, it's more, when I think, how can you limit the state from later intervening and stopping the growth of what are interstitial strategies? Because I think that's a big problem. I think that's a big problem in things like rideshare programs that start up often get limited by the state because of pressure from capital, say that you can't do rideshare because you're infringing on the bus companies. Bus companies need a license to run buses. Rideshare should need, once you give someone money for gas, you're paying them for a ride. You should need a permit. And so things are shut down for reasons like that, but I think it's more of reasons that the interstitial or actors in the dominant system realize that the interstitial strategies actually have a huge amount of potential to overtake what is the monopoly of bus companies or things like that. So I think they can go a lot much farther than a co-op, than the scale of a co-op does. And I guess sometimes I find it hard to think of a store as a model for a growing interstitial strategy, because I don't think the goals of all the people in a store or all the people who may form an owner's co-op for a store is necessarily for it to grow. Or to achieve, one of the larger...
Right, no, I think that is
that you're
right.
Trying to
I think that is one of the limiting factors of the cooperative model, is that it only pertains to those who are directly involved, mm-hmm. owner members or whatever, that there isn't that need to...
think one of the things like that seems to be important to consider is the state of things and the time that you're trying to create something new. You know, for example, like we're talking about co-ops right now, but there have been over the past several weeks a lot of rioting in several countries in Africa and Haiti, having to do with food shortages and the state, in essence, not stepping in when these food distributors are striking. Hiking up prices, and everybody's taken to the streets because prices have gone really high over a short period of time, and they feel like they're not able to maintain their own livelihood, and you know, in terms of eating and everything. So, if it's a situation in which people are you know, responding to the circumstances in which they're living, then I think the you know, their willingness to take on any ideas or strategies that the state presents to them would be a lot more acceptable to them if it's something that's relieving their problems. But if not, then I don't think people are going to be inclined to agree, because now, you know, the states, you know, it's particularly like in Haiti and other countries, and what comes to mind is Egypt. There's rioting in small towns in Egypt. But, you know, now the state's having to you know, assure them that they're going to work in their best interest, but you know, they're not necessarily willing to listen to them at this point. I think there's, you know, the presidential compound in Haiti is pretty much had people all around it, you know, yesterday and today, because they're just it's a very difficult situation. So I really think it has to do with, and so we're dealing with a co-op when people are hungry and people are starving, as opposed to, you know, a luxury to the, you know, to cops. Then I think we're dealing with a completely different set of circumstances.
Yeah, and I think that there's something about co-op formation that, like in times of crisis, that people, so two examples I'm thinking of are the Union Cab, which came, is a cooperative and didn't used to be a cooperative, but there's it had to do with a union and a strike, and then out of that crisis, the cooperative was formed, and a healthcare cooperative, which was essentially formed because of the health home care workers were not making it wages. So it was in, I think that there is something about a crisis situation which can make other alternatives viable, at least in terms of achieving that.
Yeah, and besides that is the class and, character of the co-op. Like if you compare a consumer co-op in a stable economy, well, it's not the same like a housing co-op in or working class, so or something.
But in terms of, I mean, so there's the issue of how co-ops get created, but I thought that Eric's question was sort of about long-term viability. So so getting back to sort of how do co-ops work, and let's say we're talking about producer co-ops without the state, so based on these sort of anarchist principles, we're saying, well, okay, so first of all, the state can't provide financing, right? So I'm going to assume that capital is sort of somehow really important for co-ops, and unless there's some sort of source of capital for co-ops other than, you know, bank loans or whatever, they're not viable. I don't know, maybe someone wants to disagree with that. But so we have to have some sort of special form of financing. The state's out. So let's say now we have, you know, pension funds or socially responsible investment funds or whatever. So maybe that's a viable solution. But how do we know that those kinds of funds are going to actually want to invest in our co-ops, right? Because they have other objectives, including, you know, maximizing the returns to unionized workers and their pensions and so on and so forth. So without, I don't know if this sort of stricture on the state excludes things like the state stipulating that certain kinds of funds have to invest in certain kinds of ways. It seems like if that's out, now we're sort of...
Well, you know, nothing is out in the sense of... I'm not meaning to make an arbitrary claim that it no longer counts as an effective strategy the moment you get any state involvement. The anarchist tradition says that there is a trap when you seek aid from the state, even if it's of the form of getting the state to pass a law that allocates a certain amount of resources through taxation or through rules that regulate pension funds to the co-op sector, for example. That if that if that's the way you end up getting your resources, by getting a capitalist state to create a rule that enables you to do it, that will increase the likelihood that the resulting structures you build will end up reproducing and strengthening capitalism rather than constituting some alternative principle, precisely because you have violated your own self-organization and your own autonomy, and you're no longer representing a counter-institution to that. Now, that we can criticize that view. So one response to the interstitial strategy view is that the interstitiality of it does doom it to marginality. And that's why you either want to be a revolutionary rupturalist or a symbiotic social democrat, you know, those two state-centered or state-facilitated strategies. And that maybe then in those contexts there's some space for some interstitial aspects. But that then means really rejecting that interstitial kind of logic. And so then so my challenge was, well, are we being too quick to reject it? Or perhaps they are right, that if you seek cooperation of the state, you're just seeking limits on what you can possibly achieve.
Well, I would say, I think that we're not being too quick. We're being correct to reject it if we're saying the state can't be involved in financing and it can't be involved in requiring other kinds of institutions to finance co-ops. Then I'm going to, as a non-anarchist socialist, I'm going to say, forget about it. That's a joke. But I have another question, which is, I actually don't understand why. I thought that the distinction between interstitial and symbiotic had more to do with the fact that symbiotic transformations improve the viability of capitalism somehow in the short term. So it seems like you could have state-centered interstitial transformations.
The symbiotic, as we'll see next week, the basic premise there is that there's all sorts of ways of winning concessions from the state just through a show of force. You know, so there are historical moments where working class parties and insurgent, you know, militant organizations are capable of causing enough trouble that they win concessions that are simply reflect the defeat of their opponents. So not all concessions that you win from the state are symbiotic. Some of them are just victories and you've harmed your enemies. The argument of symbiotic transformations is that those, the kinds of victories you win that don't also improve the functioning of the system in some way, are going to be very precarious. Because they're only going to survive so long as you have this very high level of mobilization to keep enforcing the threat of punishment. And as soon as you're weakened for whatever reasons, and there's good reason to believe that social movements burn out, the capacity to create trouble is not, can't be maintained at that pitch, then there's a rollback. And you're unable to defend your gains unless the gains also serve in some way or other to solve some kind of problem at the system level. Social democracy, then, the argument goes, was successful in institutionalizing a stable welfare state in Northern Europe because it discovered a second equilibrium, so to speak, that capitalism can function under a variety of regimes quite efficiently. Well, the social democratic equilibrium turns out to be a very stable one because it makes for a very stable form of capitalism, but it's one in which the equilibrium provides for a very different distribution of income and of power in the society, but still one that makes capitalism work well. And that is why it wasn't so easy to roll it back whenever there's an ebb and flow of politics. So I agree that there are victories that can be won just by force. And that's what I call the negative class compromise, where you get gains. It's not everything you want, it's some of what you want, but it's just because of your ability to impose punishment. Those, I think, are less stable. I mean, the argument behind symbiotic strategies is that the victories you get that are just a matter of balances of power and your ability to impose sanctions will be less stable. They won't have that ratchet-like quality. I mean, that was a long-winded clarification of a small point on your...
Well, I'm just saying, I mean, so it seems like there could be interstitial interstitial strategies that involve the state in an important way, and interstitial strategies that do not involve the state in an important way. And anarchists won the latter. And I don't know why. It seems like you're asking us to impose this stricture which says we're not going to allow the state to be involved in our co-ops in certain kinds of ways and things of that nature. And that seems to be historically related to our anarchist friends who don't want to get involved in the state, but come on, we're all good Marxists here, and so we don't have that problem. And so, I mean, that's evaluating interstitial strategies on its weakest front, which is interstitial strategies alone without some sort of state, systematic state support of some kind. At least I think that that's a pretty weak version of
it. I feel like we've misrepresented anarchist philosophies with regard to interstitial strategy in a very slight way, which is that I don't know much about the classical anarchists. I know a little bit more about contemporary anarchists. And they, I think, would say that, first of all, they would agree to the slogan, smash the state, which we've sort of identified with a ruptural transformation. And I think they would say that rather than the role of interstitial activities being some sort of either slow or cataclysmic overthrow of capital, I think they would say that those activities are necessary in order to support something like counter-hegemony, though they probably wouldn't use that word, they might. And then they would also say that you don't just engage in interstitial activities or interstitial strategies, but you use them as a supporter, as one element in some sort of concerted campaign to overthrow the state, and that you get rid of the state altogether. And I think they would claim that once you do, capitalism itself couldn't stand on its own two legs, or maybe one. Whatever. I don't know that interstitial activities are necessarily directed at the overthrow of capitalism in this way that anarchists view them. I think anarchists see interstitial activities as support for a more solidaristic movement to overthrow the state, which then would undermine the viability of capitalism and open up much more of a space for those interstitial activities to take over or to squeeze out capitalist activities.
I mean, it's certainly true that the smash the state slogan is an anarchist slogan. It's sort of, whereas the ruptural model is smash first, build second around the state.
Yeah.
This is just smash the state.
And leave it down. Yeah.
And build the society, but not build a new state.
Yeah.
I do think that certainly classical anarchism, but I think this has been an ongoing theme, argues very much that if you don't build alternative institutions, this side of the rupture and destruction of the state, the destruction of the state would not, in fact, first of all, you couldn't destroy the state, and second of all,
no, I agree with that. That you must have these interstitial activities, but they alone are not sufficient for an overthrow of capitalism.
And so it's the first of my two. I have these two models of the historical path. And its rupture as the culmination of successful interstitial building. That is, you still have to have a rupture, as opposed to the New Age version of anarchism, which is the endless proliferation of alternative ways of doing things will reach some tipping point which just reconfigures the whole system. That's, you know, that's this, the more benign view of how you could have a cumulative interstitial strategy producing the dawning of the age of Aquarius. And so the hippie view of anarchism was more the universalization of the hippie commune rather than it being the prologue for a more energetic destruction of state institutions itself, which would. But still, in either version, there still is a big space, not a small space, for interstitial institution building that is not under state direction, so that at most it's under state permission, so that there may be that you have to do something to create the spaces if they are being repressed and prohibited. But that's a much more limited engagement with the state than seeking, applying for grants and getting subsidies from the state and having to conform to certain particular specifications in order to get those subsidies, and then getting licensed to get the subsidies, and you know, all the things that would come along with trying to really use the state for purposes of building these alternative ways of doing things. Most of the things people have said have been specific to the question of co-ops. That's, of course, only one of the multiplicity of interstitial kinds of activities. You know, Wikipedia is another interstitial activity. It has virtually no state support whatsoever. I mean, I suppose there's some general sense in which the whole internet, you know, is underwritten by the Defense Department. But it's more a case of the internet having interstitial possibilities. So it's, you know, it is a resource that was created by the system, and the dominant system of capitalist and statist relationships. But then it can be exploited for other purposes besides the ones for which it was designed. And that's what renders this interstitial. It's not that it doesn't take advantage of resources that exist by virtue of state or capitalist action. It's just that it's not under the direction of those agencies.
I don't think you need to bring the state into the picture in order to start seeing some inherent limitations in some, at least some, interstitial activities. I think one of the problematic issues that you pointed out about workers' co-ops is that when they scale up, they tend either to begin operating, or they have strong structural incentives to begin operating like either a firm which hires workers instead of internalizing more members, or they have an incentive not to scale up in order to prevent that dilemma from happening in the first place. We also see how unions without a very strong labor movement don't gain much traction one way or the other as long as they're negotiating with their one firm. You know, and that brings us back, I think, to the problems of either scalability or the way I was trying to say it, which was some mechanism of just stealing your phrase of recombinant decentralization. That it's hard to see this spontaneous, or, you know, the transformation of society as a whole based on interstitial activities arising without some mechanism that we don't see in interstitial activities empirically today.
So it's like a social movement issue.
Or something. It could be a social movement, it could be a party, right?
Call it a modern prince. You can't have any institutional coherent interstitial activities without a
communist party or without something. A social movement.
You have to have a state. That's what the prince is. It's a state.
But it doesn't have to be centralized. I think anarchists would argue that if it's spontaneous in Luxembourg's sense of spontaneous, and if it's decentralized and horizontal, it can still work as long as everybody's rising up with some sense of coherence. I don't know.
Well, it won't last long. A mass strike doesn't last for very long. And she understood the importance of having a party too.
Yeah.
I mean, what the question is whether a modern prince has to be a communist party, and what is the modern prince? But I can't see how interstitial activities can scale up, I like that, without having some institution, some equivalent of a state. Sorry, I couldn't resist intervening there.
No, it's fine. But there's a big difference between the equivalent of the state and the state, if by the equivalent of the state one means a movement of movements, for example. In Quebec, with respect to one domain of interstitial activity in the social economy, there is an association of associations called the Chantier de l'économie sociale, the Social Economy Workshop, which describes itself as a movement of movements, and which functions as a coherence-creating, network-building association for those activities. So the sense in which they are scaled up is not that the individual entities engaged in the interstitial activity get bigger and bigger, but they become more and more connected to a broad project of creating the conditions for those things. Now, of course, it's also true in the Quebec case that I think these strategies can be thought of as symbiotic, not just interstitial, because they do have a close connection to the strategy of the problem of the provincial state. The Chantier, I think, has some kind of quasi-official recognition as at least in the more corporatist forms of Quebec negotiations around these things. The Chantier represents these particular social movements in those negotiations, so they are partners within these sort of tripartite-type corporatist institutions. In a way, I think the way I would think of the social economy in Quebec is it's a combination of interstitial strategies and symbiotic strategies that work through associational democracy rather than primarily through representative democracy, because it articulates to the state through things like the social summits, which get held periodically in Quebec, which are kind of corporatist bargaining, consensus-forming institutions. So I think there is, it seems to me that a coherent interstitial strategy, whatever its limits might be, would still have to include state-like coherence-producing and solidarity-producing processes. That still is a big difference from actually using the state, which may also, of course, be necessary. In my chapter as well as in the sentiments expressed here, there's a skepticism that you can even rely just on state-like processes, that ultimately, for these things to really have an impact, you have to directly enlist the state, which then represents a skepticism about placing interstitial strategies really at the center of these processes, as opposed to them being just part of a menu of strategic possibilities.
I just add up on the Quebec case, I very much agree with you, and I like the way you pronounce it, the Chantier de l'économie sociale, perfect pronunciation. But the difference with the interstitial, though, is that the symbiotic strategy in Quebec, well, I think as it applies to Quebec, what's interesting is that the state produces the regulations and carves the market for all these, the groups or whatever, the employers that distribute services. Whereas the difference with the interstitial is that they're pretty much just framed with regulations.
Yes, I think
so. There's kind of a continual involvement of the state to carve, you pronounce it, niches, in the social economy. So it's kind of a cartel, more or less.
Yeah. So I think, as I understand what happened in Quebec, is that the social economy movement was initially quite independent of the state. It was initially social movements trying to provide certain kinds of services and to meet human needs through this non-state, non-market form, basically community-based production of services. But that at a particular moment, they saw the opportunity of enlisting the state to regulate the market in order to consolidate their spaces for this. And they decided to run the risk that anarchists would have objected to by getting the state heavily involved in reproducing a secure niche for them, a secure space for them within this structure, which has certainly allowed them to grow. So the number of elder care co-ops and child care associations in Quebec grew fantastically once they were protected by the state, and once the state provided that barrier to market pressures. So in that sense, it was a big success, but it does, of course, generate this kind of dependency. That's, I think, inherent in any symbiotic strategy. Just bites the bullet and says, yes, that kind of dependency is one of the ramifications of this sort of strategy. but it still provides for an advance relative to what you could possibly securely or stably achieve in the absence of that state-based guarantee.
That's interesting, but the way I think I see it too is that the state is dependent, or the social economy is dependent on the state, but in Quebec, they probably treat the child care services as an acquired good. So if the service is dismantled, then you're going to have protests. The state tried to increase tuition fees 2 years ago when the university shut down over 24 hours, and they stormed the premier's office and said, no, we're not going to allow that. And so there's already kind of, I mean, that collective conscience. I don't want to say that, but there's an interest for people to keep the service in place, although right. It's dependent. The state is somewhat has a foothold in the game.
And just one little comment on that. That is itself an indicator that what we're talking about is indeed a symbiotic transformation, because remember, the quid pro quo in a symbiotic transformation is enhancing social power and solving some kind of system problem. And the fact that you have a quick trigger point for mobilization and protest, which is effective with respect to preventing the state from crossing some line, does reflect the capacity for action, which is social power. And social power is the capacity for collective action based on voluntary association, and that's essentially, you know, what is indicated by that example. Catherine, you were...
I was going to say, I don't think that's... Like, that reaction point, I think, can also happen with interstitial strategies. Because you start, as they build, you create an expectation that they will continue. And it's true they may be dependent on laws that frame the legality of that activity. But once you take away... So you were to take away the right of unions... or things like that, you would have an equally strong reaction, because even though it's not state-sponsored or symbiotic, and maybe it started off as interstitially, it still becomes a win and a def...
Said in French, Guillaume will...
I'll understand, yeah.
An acquis.
An acquired good.
Something
taken for granted.
Becomes an acquired good that you can no longer, like, even if they are interstitial, you notice it when your right to participate in that interstitial activity is taken away. And I think it can provoke equally strong reactions, whether it's symbiotic or interstitial, which just reinforces that the fact that I think interstitial activities are really key. And that's why things like the milk, the non...
But this is all kind of managed by the state.
If, everything we do. I don't think there's anything that's not managed by the state.
It's,
at all.
If there's a pro...
It's very class, in fact.
Well, no, but in a different way, for example, education is all managed by the state. So if tuition fees increase, people know where to voice their protest. Mm. If a co-op shuts down, who's your target?
But no,
the state, the capitalist, or...
The co-op shuts down. There's different reasons. I mean, it can shut down because of regulations. People to protest. You take away, when government interferes in unions' rights to strike, that becomes an issue of contention, even more important almost than the reasons for striking in the first place.
But I think that's an interesting point about the target of protests, and with this, I mean, the state is a clear target, whereas if you, like, any sort of economic base. I mean, I'm trying to think of strategies of boycotts, or what are some other specific social movements geared towards non-state, or where the target is not the state. I don't know if that makes some difference between interstitial and symbiotic strategies for transformation or protest or something. I don't know.
The notion of symbiotic strategy doesn't necessarily mean it's just with respect to the state.
Okay.
It's simply the expression of the idea of the strategy is that there is a particular form of compromise that takes place in which there's social empowerment that's harnessed to solve some kind of system problem. That can occur within capitalist firms, for example. It can be something there could be symbiotic strategies inside of a firm. The class compromises at the point of production that involved greater worker cooperation and association in the form of works councils, for example, in exchange for more discipline, which made firms more productive, was a what I would call a positive class compromise at the point of production, but which also had this symbiotic quality to it. Workers were more had more consolidated power by virtue of that associational activity within production than they would have simply by virtue of their roles in the division of labor. But it also enabled certain kinds of problems for capital to be solved more easily. So it doesn't have to be, the symbiotic form doesn't have to be just directed at the state. We haven't heard from Buenos Aires for a while. Do you want to enter into this discussion?
In fact, I was going to ask you to repeat the last thing you said, because I think that's the very important. Because I agree with some of the participants that there is a difficulty in the interstitial strategy, in the interstitial aspect. If, for example, we refer to the cops, that is the example that you said there. Why? Because if the element that make the distinction between the interstitial and the symbiotic strategy is the element that the relation with the state. But in fact, the cops have a very strong relation with the state. Here in Argentina, if we just refer to the cops that are involved in the takeover enterprises process, they are demanding all the time legislation. In fact, there is a national administration that reduce the labor of the cops. In Brazil, it's the same. The ANTIAC is the National Association of the cops, and have a very strong relation. So I think there must be, it has to be more clear what is the specific element of the relation with the state, that allow us to distinguish between the interstitial strategy and the symbiotic strategy. There must be a specific element of in the relation with the state, and not just a relation, an abstract relation.
I think the confusion comes from the fact that when you pick concrete empirical examples of particular social movements or strategies, they combine all sorts of different elements. So that, and one of the things which, in fact, I've argued in the book and will strengthen in the as yet unwritten conclusion, is that the way to think about these strategic issues around logics of transformation is precisely how to combine them, rather than trying to figure out how to most purely adopt one or another. So the basic idea of an interstitial strategy is that you get on with the business of building alternative institutions in the existing society in the here and now, trying to prefigure as best as you can the actual functioning of the alternatives that you wish to generalize for the society as a whole. And to the extent that you can do that inside the existing structures of power and domination and inequality, if you're building alternative ways of doing things inside of this existing structure, the struggle to build those things is, in fact, an interstitial strategy, because you're building things in the interstices, in the spaces possible in the society. It's saying it that way does not itself give the additional element, and, oh, by the way, you can't use the state as part of that. So the way I just described it is an interstitial strategy is a strategy which attempts to build alternatives right now inside of the spaces within the existing society. I also, though, in the chapter, I didn't reread it for today to see how, if I'm clear enough on this, do suggest that when you ask the state to do something for you, so then that isn't, that's not interstitial in the same sense. So, for example, if in providing childcare services, there's a need for childcare services for working class families. One strategy is for a social movement for childcare to demand that the state build childcare centers, hire the childcare workers, and provide this service as part of the rights of workers. So the spirit for building childcare centers would be the same as public schools, just extended to an earlier age. The interstitial strategy for building childcare services is for a social movement for childcare to organize the provision of childcare services and then perhaps engage the state in order to facilitate the expansion and the protection of those community-based, collectively organized forms of service delivery. It may, in fact, be absolutely necessary for the survival of those non-capitalist, decommodified, community-based childcare services that they have state protection. And so in engaging the state may be an absolutely necessary part of building the alternative. That's still a very different relationship to the state than demanding that the state provide those services for you. Doing it yourself enhances the collective capacity to provide for human needs. Asking the state to do it enhances state capacity to provide for needs. So that's the sense in which the interstitial strategy articulates itself to the state in a different way from a conventional statist strategy. Both represent transformations. That is, the state providing daycare is non-capitalist. They both represent transformations of capitalist relations, but one does so in a way that embodies the principles of socialism as social empowerment, and the other one at least does so in a less direct or a weaker way because it's centered around state action.
But in that case, when we are when a group is just demanding from the state whatever it needs without actually doing a kind of compromise, saying we give you this and you give us whatever, would that be a kind of ruptural strategy, or be kind of just demanding?
I didn't give a label to that form, and maybe I should. I mean, I've argued that there are these three strategies: ruptural, interstitial, and symbiotic. There's a fourth strategy that we've invoked, which is simply winning demands through the mobilization of power. That sort of concessionary strategies. You simply try to win concessions from powerful actors, whether it be the state. So a kind of conventional union strategy is through a show of force to force a wage increase, and in which your capacity to win wage increases is a function of your capacity to impose harms through struggle. That's not a ruptural strategy. You're not destroying, you're not attempting to break the property relations. It's not symbiotic. You're not attempting to create a stable equilibrium of positive compromise. It's not interstitial. It's not just working in the cracks of the system to accomplish things. So I'm not sure what to exactly call it. I don't think a term like confrontational works, because there's confrontations in all of these. I mean, all of these involve conflict and struggle. It's not that that's the struggle solution and these all others are, you know, sweetness and harmony solutions. No, they all involve struggle.
I don't
necessarily think, or I think that can, strategy can be understood on the same spectrum as symbiotic. Because essentially, you're making a compromise between the system not working and the system working. And how it plays out is about the long, what are the long term, your ability at the long term to maintain that working for both people, for both groups, is what will preserve that system or not.
But making the system work by simply refraining from disrupting it is really a, I think that's a different, it's not just a different point on a spectrum. That is, raising wages has two relationships to the stability of capitalism. One is, it may solve a problem, that is, the Keynesian problem of inadequate demand. When unions figured out that raising wages helped to stabilize the capitalist market, then they were embarking on a more symbiotic. And when capitalists realized that, then they were forging a symbiotic equilibrium, because then the demands of workers for higher wages also served a function for the collectivity of capitalists. That's different when the only reason for granting wage increases is because of the damage of the strike, and not because wage increases provide for stability in the functioning of the economy. So I'm not sure. Yeah, go on.
Oh, no, I'm like, I guess that makes sense in terms of the perception of the actors, but not, but doesn't really distinguish the behaviors. But if it's a strategy, it's true that it's a strategy is about your perspective about what you're doing, rather than just the behavior.
I mean, in both cases, there could be a strike as a, you know, as the collective action of workers, but it would have different meanings in these two. Mm-hmm. These two kinds of strategic contexts. Todd?
I guess we're getting bogged down in this sort of classification of strategies, and I think that the state issue, it seems like it's turned out to be somewhat of a red herring, because it seems like, from what you're saying, the state really is not the distinguishing, the relation to the state is not this distinguishing feature between interstitial and symbiotic strategies. It's sort of a feature, but it's not, the key issue is whether it improves the equilibrium, right? Versus not interfering with the equilibrium at all, right? And so, to me, I thought the interesting issue was, we know that interstitial strategies are viable in the short run. What we don't know is how viable they are in the long run and how scalable they are, which is sort of the issue that we started with. So I would make the argument, which I already did make the argument, I'll make it again, that they're not viable without some form of state support or state-like or whatever. But I think that the interesting question is going from there to say, well, what in fact is necessary and how far can we go with state support. And what I think is interesting about the Argentine case with the occupied factories was precisely that, you know, they were pretty smart. They appealed to the state for some form of support pretty quickly. They didn't say, oh, no, we're going to do this all on our own. We don't need the state. We don't need anything. I mean, the slogan was what? State ownership and workers control.
Right? Yeah, so that was one of the slogans.
So I
different.
I
there
think
no, there were different political
right.
lines. One
yeah.
was that.
Well, I don't know.
The
I,
other,
I
was,
go
the other was the more classic cooperative,
right.
Like asking the state to legalize the cooperative as such. Yes, you're right.
But one way or another, there was a recognition that the role of the state was going to be really important. Now, maybe it was really minimal in the sort of anarchist kind of sense, but it was just appealing for recognition. But I think we should be talking about what, you know, not how far could you go without the state or without some sort of subsidiary forms of organization that would make co-ops and other strategies more viable, but how far could you go with those additional kind of organizations? So.
Well, and to tack
off
on
the box,
to the, and sure. to add to that, I think, furthermore, the question is, are they desirable? Because depending on who the participants are and the nature of those changes, are those really going to lead in the end to genuine changes and not changes that either reproduce or reinforce particular aspects of the system? So that was with my question of bringing in, well, you know, who are participants? Is there enough working class? Is that kind of, those kind of strategies themselves being genderfied? I think that's, the desirability is actually a good question. And if in the short run we're not having an effect on the state or engaging the state somehow, you know, is that going to translate into real change in the end? Because as we've kind of demonstrated by going around and trying to think of ways that you can completely do something outside the state, it's apparently almost impossible to actually come up with alternatives that don't somehow require a central organizing body or that kind of collective aspect.
But I think there's a lot of solutions, and the idea of there's a lot of solutions that are created which don't necessitate the recreation of a state at that scale. And they're limited, but they can be multiplied. Like the unpasteurized milk movement in the U.S. is really fascinating for that reason, because you don't need to centralize that. It doesn't make sense to centralize it. It works between the laws that exist in different places. And centralizing it just would not make any sense.
But that's what I'm saying, that we know that, for example, for agricultural commodities, you can have various kinds of relatively small-scale cooperative collection systems because they're luxury goods in a capitalist system, and because people are willing to pay a premium for organic, for cooperatively produced, right? We know that. But the question is, how do you get cooperatively produced steel beans? How do you get cooperatively produced, you know, mass commodities? Can you? I mean, that, right?
Well, when you look at the reason why reaction against local money systems has been very strong by the government sometimes is because the economy is developed in a way that could make that possible and where it could be a threat to the mainstream system.
I mean, I think that the movement to tax local money is because they can tax it and because it's a potential source of revenue to the state, not because it's a threat necessarily. But
I think we should move further down the list. We should also take a break in a few minutes. But Ricardo, yours is the next. Interrogation in the list, if you want to raise some of the issues from your document.
Yes, there were many questions about these traditions affirmation, but I want to focus on one especially. The one about the prefigurement, the prefiguration. Prefiguration. Well, you take as an example for this interstitial transformation. One thing that you call equal trade, I suppose that that's what here we call trueque.
It's like
trueque is barter.
Yeah, that's barter. It's fair trade. Is
comercio justo.
Comercio justo, fair trade. I was wondering is how it is determined that some experiences, embodied principles of a new society. Because when I think in this fair trade, I think that this is based on the principle that you have to change similar or equal goods, and that is a principle of a market or a mercantile relationship. But there are some other principles, like the classical one about that says that poses that the a new society must base on that from each according to his ability and to each according to his need, and that one is another or other alternative principle of organization. And how you determine that which one is correct or which one is right, and which one is the one that new society must be based on, and who determines that? Who chooses between principle or the other? And thinking about this example, I add that I think that this lead us to the problem of prefiguration. That is a classical critic to the anarchist principles, because it's somewhat authoritarian to think that a group of people in our society can determine which would be the most correct principles to organize a new one. Because if you think that a new society must be made by the masses, and that masses could build a new society basing on its own their own political conscious decisions. Is it not somewhat authoritarian to think that these principles could be previously established without this free, active, and conscious action of the masses?
You know,
I think he wasn't referring to fair trade.
No, I understand.
Yeah,
yeah. So let me make a couple of comments to start a dialogue around this. Interstitial strategies may be ineffective, but it's hard for me to see why they would be described as authoritarian, because they are not authoritatively imposing them on anyone. The idea of interstitial strategies for building alternatives that prefigure a more socially just society is that groups of people, workers, others, attempt to forge new kinds of social relationships in the existing society, but not attempt to impose them on other people, because they don't. The model of interstitial transformation is not to capture state power and impose a prefigured model on everybody. It's to build experimentally alternatives and then to demonstrate their attractiveness as embodying more egalitarian and democratic principles than their rivals. So the experimentalism of an interstitial strategy strikes me as profoundly anti-authoritarian in its character. It may also be profoundly ineffective. That's another question. it's certainly a basis for the critique of it, but it's, I don't see why they would be criticized as being authoritarian. On the fair trade idea, I think there's some issue as to what the expression, what we mean in North America when we use that expression, fair trade. It's the idea behind the fair trade movement, or sometimes referred to as equal exchange, is precisely to break with the idea that the only way you evaluate a commodity is in terms of its equivalence to another commodity. That logic of equivalence erases from the commodity its history. What the fair trade movement wants to do is to label the history of the commodity on the commodity, namely that it was produced under by worker-owned co-ops, for example. One strand of the fair trade movement wants to have labels on the product saying this was produced by workers under cooperative conditions with living wages and certain labor standards met. There's a fair trade coffee roaster in Madison called Just Coffee. Just meaning only coffee, but also coffee made under conditions of social justice. It's a fair trade coffee roaster called Just Coffee, and they certify that the coffee beans that they sell were produced by worker co-ops. Now, that means that the anonymity of the production process is lost, that these identify, in fact, you can go to their website and see which co-op produced which bag of beans so that they track it all the way back to the actual people who produced it. The consumers pay a premium for that coffee because there's, of course, costs involved with tracking and monitoring the coffee. But it's the idea is then that the consumers in the North establish a non-impersonal relation through this associational intermediary with direct producers in the South who produce under these cooperative conditions. That fair trade, that's what we mean by fair trade in this social movement context. The fair trade coffee is a deep violation of capitalist markets in its logic, because it's insisting that the nature of the exchange relation be structured by the transparency of the production relations under which it occurred. And I think it's it may be ineffective. You know, again, I'm not passing judgment as to whether expanding the scope of those things, but I don't think one would want to describe this as an authoritarian model. It's a social justice model for trade, engaged in by people committed to democratic egalitarian principles of social justice, but not imposing it, but building it through cooperative relations.
Is there exploitation in that movement, you think?
Catherine.
I think there's an important distinction about fair trade coffee. It's not fair trade, it's fair purchasing, which is really different than trade, because in trade you would assume you were getting an equal purchasing. More conceptually, trade is more related to concepts of what you can get back in exchange, as opposed to what you can buy for the money.
But it's referred to,
it is referred to as
fair trade. That's the...
But it's more, I think trade embodies a larger concept than fair purchase price.
The idea is to eliminate exploitation from the relationship so that it is fair in that sense as well. That's why it also sometimes goes under the expression equal exchange to contrast with unequal exchange. That is, the rhetorical contrast is, again, in the kind of dependency in Marxian literature, unequal exchange being the typical relationship between North and South. Equal exchange means that the producers in the South get full value for what they produce. Which, given the nature of the global economy, means that consumers in the North have to pay a premium. Not because they're getting premium quality. Indeed, that's one of the problems.
It's fine coffee, I think.
It's fine, but it's not as good. You can get better coffee by going for the exploited. I think it's the best. I think this is a case where my position is it's certainly good enough. it's not the best, but it's good enough. So I mean, I think that things like the fair trade coffee, particularly its more radical versions, just coffee is the more radical version of it because it's very careful about the monitoring, about the labeling. You know, the problem with all of these systems is that the costs of careful monitoring of the source of production, turns out to be quite complicated. And probably that's a case where to scale it up would require the state, that it's because of the cost of monitoring and enforcing the labeling and monitoring processes. But in any case, my feeling is the fair trade coffee is an example of something which does exactly what one would want an interstitial strategy to be. That is, people have just built these networks because they felt it was in the service of social justice. They demonstrate that you actually can connect a coffee co-op in Guatemala with consumers in Madison, that the connection costs something, but not a huge amount. It can be organized in that way. And therefore, it's a model of a different way of relating between peasant producers and coffee drinkers in North America. Then the question of whether this could ever challenge Starbucks, whether it could challenge the corporate structure of global coffee, well, I think it's an illusion that this could just be scaled up incrementally by convincing people that this is the way to go, that it needs probably more than just a social movement around social justice and international trade in order for it to scale up in ways that would challenge corporate power in the coffee industry. And I find it hard to imagine how that could happen without the state being involved. But the strategy, the logic of the strategy is that you challenge corporate capitalism by creating an alternative network of ways of doing it. And then the next political question is, how would you generalize that?
I think there's one interesting, about the fair trade coffee in particular, I think there's an interesting institutional glitch in it right now, which is worth thinking about because it runs contrary to some of the ideals, which is that the standards are just not are fine in the North, not in the South. Often the co-ops have a lot of difficulty. Some of the standards just don't make as much sense to them.
What sort of thing?
I'm trying to think. Like everything from work hours, family members working, because they're in places where family members.
And co-ops would like to exploit themselves more than.
Yes. Well, because if you're still not making an adequate salary,
self-exploitation is a point.
You would, and so, but it's just interesting that they're not part of the design of the standards that make it fair. Especially as when it started off, they were more, but as fair trade has grown, the standards have been universalized, so they don't reflect the different needs in different areas and the different priorities of what people want.
Which I think goes back to Ricardo's point, and the one I'm trying to get at earlier about who's participating, who's creating these alternatives, and is there enough participation from below? Is there enough diversity in these kind of movements, in these kind of strategies that make it desirable in the end?
And I think it does get to the point about authoritarianism as well, because to the extent that, not just with coffee and where co-ops are involved, but with sort of labor standards kinds of things, where the labor standards don't include, say, the right to unionize and things of that nature, which is in fact the case with a lot of these labor standards, it becomes a divisibility problem, right? Where if you had a labor standard that included, you know, stuff about working conditions and the right to unionize, maybe we would be talking, right? But the moment you take out the right to unionize, then you have affluent consumers in the North saying, hey, look, we're taking care of you. We have this corporate code of conduct or whatever. You're going to be fine. Well, you know, that starts to smack to me of authoritarianism. So,
yeah,
And so it's a matter of where these kind of institutions grow. Like, because when I came to the U.S., one of the things that struck me most was this kind of consumers' commitment to the products. I said, in Argentina, that's why Ricardo got confused between fair trade and, how do you call it, trueque?
Barter.
Barter. Because we don't really know many examples of this. There are, and maybe now there are more than when I came to the U.S., but this kind of logic that can only be imposed, like what Eric was saying, when the consumer can pay a premium, like can pay an extra, they have enough wealth to say, okay, I care about this product. So, I mean, that's something also. What kind of externalities can these institutions bring when this is the assumption that the consumer has enough money to spend?
Part of the reasoning of the social justice-oriented fair trade movement is that if these do get scaled up enough, then in fact, it doesn't have to be a luxury, a form of luxury consumption. That is, a properly organized social justice trade system would not imply that you're paying a premium just because you have a taste for social justice, because you cut out a lot of the middlemen from the process, and therefore it can be a case where both the consumers, at the consumer end and the producer ends, can both benefit from a social just exchange relationship. If you create a more direct a less mediated relationship between producers and consumers. On the question of who establishes the standards, I mean, this is a hotly contested thing within the fair trade movement, and it isn't the case that it's all decided unilaterally by liberal do-gooders in the North. You know, sometimes it is and sometimes it's not. The Just Coffee in Madison is, it's my understanding that they've gone to Guatemala and discussed with co-ops what should be the criteria, what level of monitoring. And one of the issues that was in play there was some of the fair trade, whoops, we lost our connection, let's... seems to happen about once...
I think it times out.
Yeah.
I think there was a window for a second.
I think it's the timing, because as I'm starting earlier now...
Hello, we're back!
It has been over.
We're back. Okay, so it's my understanding in the negotiation, in the discussions, I would say, it wasn't so much negotiation as discussion, between the Just Coffee and the Guatemala co-ops, there was the issue of, do you also want to have organic standards? Or is it enough just to have social justice standards, right? The Guatemalan farmers did not want the organic standards. They wanted to, you know, it's not that they wanted to die of pesticides, but they were to also, in addition to trying to make a co-op work, to abide by strict organic production standards would make it much harder for them. And it's my understanding that one of the reasons why the Madison Coffee Cooperative, Roasting Cooperative, pulled out of the International Fair Trade Alliance, which is the Equal Exchange Group, was precisely because they felt the Equal Exchange Group was imposing standards that were making things harder for a social justice concern. They wanted it to be just a social justice standard, not an environment, you know, not package in all these environmental and ecological standards on top of it, except insofar as they're compatible with the social justice standard. But I do think that the standards themselves were not unilateral for that coffee.
Well, no, I think it depends on the case, and there's a lot of variations across North America and Europe.
Right.
But then I think it's the process sort of thing, is the process of how you design those standards is more important in a framework of like emancipatory goals.
Right.
Than having a standard with an imposed income. No.
Molly.
This is about the scaling up thing, and I think we kind of talked about this a while ago, but and it's something I was talking about with Charity recently, about changing norms. And I think on one
And it has to do with, like, the Starbucks using fair trade, because on one hand, you could see that as a really good thing, because it's nationalizing this concept of fair trade, and it's you could see it as a step towards changing norms and making people aware and conscious raising. But then, on the other hand, it's Starbucks. It's Starbucks. So I don't know if there's, like, some contradiction between the scaling up and
co-optation.
And co-option of these movements by big corporations or whatever else they could be co-opted by.
I'm not sure they know what we are talking about, the example, because at least I didn't know about this before I came.
About the coffee example?
Yeah.
Do you understand this example we've been discussing around coffee?
In Argentina, we have only meat.
And mate.
Not exactly. What I was wondering about that is that if I understand the example is that a way to limit the exploitation in the capitalist relations. How do you pass from that limitation to exploitation to think that this could be a principle of new organization? There's something that I don't understand. How you pass from thinking that something that is limiting exploitation to a principle to organize a new society is like thinking a growth of wages. It's a way to limit exploitation, capitalist exploitation, but it's not a principle of organization of a new society.
But the example we're discussing is a principle of a new organization. It's not just about paying higher wages to coffee workers in Guatemala where the coffee is produced. It's about putting a constraint on the nature of the relationships, both within the production process of coffee and in the relationship between coffee growers and coffee consumers, to organize them in a very different way. So first of all, for this particular fair trade relationship with just coffee in Madison, it's a requirement that the workers own the coffee producer, the coffee production. They're grower co-ops. They're not capitalist firms that are growing the coffee. That's one thing. And the second is that that there are no corporate intermediaries between the producers and the coffee roasters in Madison in this particular case, so that the coffee roaster is also a workers' co-op. It's not a capitalist firm. And then the price of the coffee that's negotiated between the two is, at least in principle, meant to be one that respects principles of equal exchange rather than unequal exchange, so that there is no exploitative transfer from the growers to the roasters. Now, to create that's a new structure of relations. That's not just the structure of relations spontaneously produced by capitalist competition in the capitalist market.
Is there any study, I mean, I don't know if you want to go on with the example, but is there any study showing the actual living conditions of people in these co-ops compared to other, because I guess this can change many things, but I don't know if it would really change the health situation of the kids in the family, or the monthly income. I don't know, is there any study or like any way to know that in this discussion about
Well, we know that they get paid an awful lot more. They're paid way above the world market price for their beans. Mm-hmm. They receive way above their... So presumably that is translated into higher income,
yeah,
I would assume.
Yeah.
But I don't, as far as I know... And, you know, this is a very... Even if you take the broader fair trade in coffee, not... I mean, what we're talking about here is... The radical end, you know, the really demanding radical end of this kind of practice. If you take the entire one, I think it still amounts to only 4 or 5% of the coffee market. You know, so it's a lot of the fair trade coffee that Trader Joe's. That's another store in Madison called Trader Joe's.
We have to do a fair trade tour.
We'll do a fair trade. We will all have a meet at the Just Coffee Coffee House and have Just Coffee Coffee when you're here to celebrate interstitial strategies of transformation.
Eric, the co-op fair trade part is 4% of the world coffee market, or
No. The fair trade. The fair, all
fair
of
trade
fair trade. I think it's about 4%. I think it's something like that. So it's a very small niche at this point, clearly. And some of that includes Starbucks and Trader Joe's brands of fair trade coffee. What I don't know is whether that's a complete scam. I mean, it still could be the case that Starbucks fair trade coffee is produced under better labor standards with higher wages than their regular coffee. It's possible. I don't know how real the standards are with respect to the corporate versions of it. Yeah.
Or, Peter, hand up first. I think an important aspect to bring into this is the reciprocity, maybe, or the entire circle that a relationship like Just Coffee creates, because it benefits, like, let's say, the employees of Just Coffee. They have their own cooperative. It's benefiting this place over here. But if you're selling this coffee through a place like Trader Joe's or Starbucks, you don't have that kind of circle of beneficiaries, I don't think, to the degree when you're dealing with the small ones, because if you look at Trader Joe's, it's still corporate, so profits are still leaving the community, whereas Just Coffee stays here. We know that certain members in our community are really benefiting directly, and then Just Coffee also, you know, they sponsor all these events, and they do all these things in the community. They donate money to the community and to different nonprofits. So I think that's a really important aspect when we talk about, well, like, what are the differences, and I think it's important.
I think that is important, but just to play devil's advocate, in my mind, the movement stems from decreasing exploitation where the coffee is produced. Mm-hmm. So if you really want to, like, maximize the potential, mm-hmm. why not try and get corporate coffee sponsors of these things? Because in my mind, I think that would matter in terms of the movement than generating the local economic benefits.
You
in
might
these
be
countries.
Actually right, but then at least the scaling up contradiction that you pointed out.
Right.
So.
I think that, I mean, in answer to sort of both things, I think just in the fair trade case, we have to separate the case where we have actual co-ops, which presumably, if I verify, are in fact co-ops in some meaningful sense, from everything else, because the fact that because small farmers who have employees are exploiting their employees, and the fact that the farmers are getting paid more per pound for coffee does by no means mean that they're paying their workers more. My understanding from Gay Seidman is that fair trade coffee is all about price per pound. There's not that as much monitoring of actual labor conditions. So in the case of the Starbucks fair trade coffee, where presumably it's not a co-op, so we know nothing about. We just know what the whoever is the kind of small capitalist farmer who's actually growing the coffee. We know how much they're getting paid. We don't know how much if that person is touching a coffee plant ever, right? So I think that's probably the major obstacle. I think it's really the coffee. As far I understand it, and again, this is mostly from Gay, that the coffee is really different from some of the monitoring schemes that are existing in the apparel industry, which is a different ballgame altogether.
all of these schemes, you know, there's a wide variety of things that go under this name, fair trade. They are examples of interstitial strategies. That is, if we ask ourselves, what can we do to try to engage in a collective action which will move us towards a alternative form of economy based on social power rather than capitalist power, one of the things we can do is try to create new forms of trade relations with producers. And one of the issues, once you decide that that's one of the things you can do, is what standards are you going to adopt? How are they going to be enforced? In the what standards that are you going to adopt, we can sit around in Madison and think up good standards, or we can be in dialogue with labor movements and other actors in third worlds to create those standards. And the monitoring, we can either attempt to create a machinery for monitoring, which is a big problem, or we can rely on some kind of good faith monitoring, right? So all of these things are complications, and one of the results is that a lot of these strategies end up being purely symbolic efforts without any real effects. There's this famous photograph of children in Pakistan sewing on the no child labor labels on garments going to Europe. So Europe had this fair trade struggles over textile to get child labor out of textile production, which they thought they had succeeded. They got agreements from all the garment manufacturers. Everybody signed on to these standards. But then some journalist got a photo of the no child labor labels being stitched on the garments by children. So the monitoring becomes a really fundamental problem in this. And it's an example of something which it's the simplest solution to the monitoring problem is, in fact, to figure out a way for the state to provide the monitoring services. States are good at that kind of thing. It's one of the things that bureaucracies with inspectorates know how to do. Social movements are not so good at monitoring because it takes a lot of personnel, it takes lots of protocols. You have to track the products. I mean, you don't just monitor them at the point of production. You have to be sure that the certified products don't get mixed up with uncertified products along the whole transportation process as they move from one place to another. All of that's very complicated. And so the natural thing is to imagine that at some point, if this were to move to a general social movement which really wanted to transform social relations, it would have to somehow or other be ratified and organized through states. It couldn't be just done in this social movement-based way. Yeah.
And also beyond the desirability and scalability, I mean, this kind of exchange takes for granted the inequalities between countries, like Guatemala produces coffee.
Well, we're not going to produce coffee in Madison no matter what.
Another cultural thing is that they drink a lot of coffee in the U.S., so that's why you can have a half an hour discussion about coffee production. They wouldn't, I mean, in Argentina, you wouldn't understand how coffee is so important for social justice, but it is.
I do think on the everybody will be here by the Thursday before the weekend, right?
Yeah.
So we should plan on the day before we go to the conference, we should all meet at Just Coffee for coffee. They probably serve tea there as well, although I don't know.
No, it's just a warehouse.
No, I thought there was a coffee shop for them.
In front, but we could play ping pong in their warehouse.
Oh, we could go in there.
Yeah.
And then you get to see all the different coffees.
Well, like, there is the Fair Trade coffee place on State Street. Don't they serve Just Coffee?
Pretty much everywhere.
It has coffee. We could drink Just Coffee. Look, it's we didn't take a break. It's 25 after 6. I think we should go for another 10 or 15 minutes and then stop because of the lecture we have this evening anyway. So, but why don't we not have an official break and just continue for another 10 or 15 minutes? Okay. The next interrogation on the list is Wes's.
Oh. All right.
So That's a good way to bully you into talking. You have interesting things to say. So you raised a bunch of different issues, but which pick something that you want
to. Can I say one final thing?
Sure.
This last conversation
sure.
we were having? Just on the issue of scalability. You know, Ido raised this point that, you know, interstitial strategy, it seems like one of the ways that they do contribute to system-wide transformation potentially is their symbolic value, right? That this becomes viable and it changes the discussion, right? The discussions that we're having about trade in the United States are different today because of fair trade and other kinds of things than they were 20 years ago. More people are having those kinds of conversations. You do have middle and upper middle class people. Right, there's a negative to this, right? You know, luxury consumption of fair trade goods. But on the positive side, is that you have this creation of coalitions and the potential for transformations of the state, right, down the road. And so it seems to me that like the normative aspect of scale is one of the big potentials of interstitial strategies is the capacity to change the debate. Even what we're talking about, which could turn into, even if you know we don't anticipate that the fair trade coffee is going to take over the market from Starbucks, right, on its own, it can still create different kinds of political coalitions and political will, right, and maybe that's one of the places where scalability is actually, where interstitial strategies actually have some level of scalability, perhaps. Mm-hmm. There's one comment.
It's symbolic scalability.
Right. Yeah, right. But that can turn into real advances in social empowerment and egalitarian change. So.
Yeah. So on your interrogation.
Should I say something else? All right.
Well,
all right.
That's on the previous
point. Okay. So my we already talked about the state, which was my first point in my interrogation. The second point was just about this distinction between interstitial activities and interstitial strategies. And so, you know, to what extent do interstitial strategies have to contain a component of a goal of, you know, system-wide transformation versus just practical problem solving at the local level, right? And it seemed like in the chapter you went back and forth a little bit in terms of, on the one hand, saying, well, a battered women's shelter could constitute an interstitial strategy, even if it isn't connected necessarily to a movement that is pursuing system-wide change. But then at other times in evaluating some of these examples of worker co-ops, et cetera, there seems to be kind of a back and forth of saying, well, these really aren't contributing to system-wide change, and so we call them interstitial activities rather than strategies. And a lot of other people raise this question of, you know, how do we distinguish between right. the two and what's necessary for real effective transformation. So
I think the way I responded to that in the, you know, in my comments was to make the point that strategies always have to involve intentionality towards some goal. That's why we're using the word strategy. And one way to think about this would be then that interstitial strategies mobilize interstitial activities for some broader purpose, in which it may or may not be always the case that the people engaged in the interstitial activities themselves share that broader purpose. So a social movement like in Quebec for the social economy, the social movement was a conscious strategy to expand a non-commodified, community-based, needs-oriented form of services. That was, among other things, what they saw as their goals. They organized to accomplish that. In so doing, they made contact with lots of groups of people in various communities who were doing lots of things, not all of whom would necessarily have conceived of their activities as having some broader purpose. They might have just seen them as solving a problem in a local context. They certainly may not have had the categories of state provision versus commodified provision versus communal. None of this stuff may have been part of their understanding of what they were doing. What renders it an interstitial strategy for transformation, I think, is some effort to bring those particular activities to bear on this broader agenda. And so it may be that the strategy should be better thought of as the strategies of social movements of political parties, of networks, of associations that are attempting to promote these things, rather than inhering in the actual, you know, practices at the moment when somebody is providing the child care in a cooperative child care center. They may or may not be acting in this broader strategic way, but what renders it part of an interstitial strategy for transformation is it being connected to these other, these broader movements. Just Coffee, then, is a kind of special case because they are a social movement coffee roaster. I mean, that was their self-understanding. They embarked on this project precisely because they wanted to transform a structure of relations, not just because they felt there was a need for bitter coffee. You know, it wasn't solving a problem in the coffee consumption market. It was solving a problem in the connection between it and production. Does that strategy activity contrast work? I mean, does that, you don't like it?
No, but kind of, I mean,
okay. I was going to say, it's kind of parallel in thinking about active versus passive reproduction, whether it's reproduction of the existing system or production of a new alternative. Like I find it kind of a similar thing. I think one of the purposes is to make more behaviors and activities active or strategic so that you're choosing to buy Just Coffee at the store rather than whatever, Folgers. It seemed like a similar...
That's an easy choice, because there you get both better coffee and...
Yeah. So okay, Starbucks definitely is the generic.
Right, no, that's all right.
No, I have the same objection. I mean, I think you're right, that we had this conversation earlier, and I don't know that it makes sense to distinguish between these things on the level of intentionality rather than the sort of level of collective organization. I think that's a much more useful distinction, but we've already had that conversation.
But can't strategy be broken to, I mean, thought of as terms of...
Well, you get into this problem of, you know, does it have to be everybody that has a sort of conscious idea, well, I'm, you know, we are transforming the world by purchasing fair trade coffee?
I think a fairly simple but fundamental contrast between, as in the feudalism to capitalism story, you know, individual merchants set about to improve their conditions of production and sale, and they engage in all sorts of activities which had as a cumulative byproduct the erosion of feudal relations over time, over, you know, decades and several centuries, right? Without anybody having as a strategic purpose the destruction of feudalism until very late in the process. Now, I'm not saying that that isn't interstitial activities that have corrosive byproducts aren't important. I just don't think social emancipation is going to be the result, is going to be an unintended byproduct of people engaging in adaptive activities for purposes of survival, preservation, aesthetics, or whatever, for whatever motivations they might have. So that while those activities might be important and could be potentially harnessed for such purposes, so long as they remain, their positive effects remain simply byproducts rather than part of the purposes of it, then I don't think they will have those cumulative effects. And that's not because of some magical belief that the intentionality is needed in order for the effects to be produced. It's because I think social emancipation is too arduous a transformation to occur simply as an accidental byproduct of other activities. And therefore, a strategy is needed, and one of the strategies that's needed is a strategy that tries to take advantage of the possibilities of building alternatives in these interstices. So that kind of strategy is needed, which may then enhance interstitial activities and mobilize them. That is, people may be doing some of this stuff anyway. People are building co-ops for reasons other than trying to change capitalism. But then a social movement for co-ops emerges, which figures out ways to facilitate the expansion of co-ops by solving some of the credit problems, by, you know, creating better information systems to provide training for would-be co-op leaders so that they learn how to avoid some standard mistakes. So you get all sorts of co-op education programs that could get generated. Those are the ones that have the strategic vision. And then they may enhance the sense of strategy among other co-op actors who otherwise wouldn't have had a strategic notion of what they were doing, which then might serve those co-ops well, because people might stay the course more if they feel that there's some broader purpose in mind. They may weather some of the trials and tribulations of building new institutions if they think it's not just because it's fun, but because it has a purpose. You know, all these things could be enhanced by strategizing it, you know, not even strategizing it, turning activity into strategy. But so I think you have to, if you don't have that distinction, you can't even talk about these, about this problem.
I don't actually disagree with you. I just think it's, I think I want to state it differently, but in some ways it's a trivial
okay.
point. I don't think we need to dwell.
Okay.
We have time for one more. Rodrigo, yours is the next one on the list. Do you want to add something?
My second question was referring to just this thing about the strategies and the activities. I think it may be interesting to take in consider not just the activities but the process, because we can find process, interstitial process, but that they don't refer to an strategy. And maybe it would be more interesting to analyze why those processes don't transform into a strategy rather than a focus in interstitial strategies, because it's more difficult to find strategies.
Yeah, I don't have any particular thoughts on why processes don't turn into strategies as a general matter. I suppose it's because most people most of the time are just trying to make it through the day and accomplish their immediate, satisfy their immediate needs rather than take on these other responsibilities that come once you imagine that what you're doing has these broader purposes. But
I think that
for example, the difficult I'm sorry, I'm going to take again the same example, but it's the issue that I work. If you ask in the COPs if there is a strategy or a process, the answer will depend on who you are asking of. So it's difficult. Some cops, some workers don't think that there is a strategy that has the proper purpose of transformation of the system, just to defend or still have a job, just that. If you ask some leaders or reference or some cops, you may find answers more at the emphasize and strategy, but it's difficult to establish when can you characterize a process as a process, just a process, or as a strategy. It's very difficult.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly true, that in terms of an outsider coming to a particular instance and asking, is this a strategy, an example of a interstitial strategy or just an interstitial process, there may not be any clear answer to that. If you're looking at the development of a wave of co-ops that are occurring at a particular time, in which there are collective actors which are arguing in favor of this as a way of both resolving the current crisis and creating an alternative, then you have, I think, a clear case of a strategy. And if it survives over time, I assume that the participants within the surviving co-ops will tend, in general, to have at least elements of that broader vision. In that movie we saw on Brookman that was shown here, where they interviewed lots of the ordinary workers there, they, of course, they know they're being filmed because it's a special case, right? But they certainly saw what they were doing as building an alternative way of working, not just surviving in the face of crisis. I mean, that was, at least that was what the film suggested.
That's an example or something that starts as a process, and now it's because the workers were saying, well, we just stayed here because the,
right,
the owner didn't come to pay the salary. And then, well, Rodrigo must know the case better than I do, but it seems that they decided to stay, and now it's a strategy of a cooperative. I don't know if you agree with this idea in the Brookman case.
Did you saw the film?
Yeah.
We didn't.
Well, when you come to Madison, we'll arrange a showing.
While we drink coffee.
While we drink coffee.
It was good. Comments.
Okay, I think we need to wrap up for today because a lot of us are going to see Michael Burovoy's lecture. By the way, if you want to listen to Michael Burovoy's lectures, they are all on the Haven Center website, so you can...
Not much interstitiality there, though. It's all rupture.
But we had there was an extremely good lecture on Gramsci versus Bourdieu, a kind of boxing match between the two. So if you want to listen to it, you can go to the Haven Center website. All right, so next week is the last of the regular seminar sessions. The chapter for next week is another one of the less revised chapters. I basically took an earlier article that I had written on the problem of class compromise, which is essentially bound up with this symbiotic strategy problem, and just slightly massaged it into this chapter. But it's not as fully elaborated a chapter as some of the other ones we've read. I think that next week we can also use the seminar session to sit back a little bit from the particulars of that chapter and raise issues about the book as a whole as well. So next week's discussion can be a little bit more freewheeling. Not that this was freewheeling, but a freewheeling discussion around symbiotic strategies and then how this all fits together into an overall argument.
Fantastic.
All right? Okay.
Can you bring wine again?
Yeah, so let's bring wine again. Who?
I'll do it. Okay. Or I'll bring some. Okay.
You bring some, okay.
Eric, are you aware that as we're building the sister-county relationship with this place called Zenare in Venezuela, we're also building a new coffee?
Yeah, money, please.
So, a new coffee?
A new coffee through Just Coffee.
Uh-huh.
So I'm hoping it'll be then better than the rest of them.
No, they're not bad. I don't mean to be too snotty.